the words, but his feet didn't comply. Wu and Indra nudged him until he finally moved.
"Arlo Flinch?"
whispered a freckled Red Ranger, proud of himself. Christian glared at him, shutting him up. "Blue Patrol Leader, do you take this ranger under your watch?" asked Christian.
"I do," said Connor. "Then present his colors. Rangers, salute!"
All of the rangers put their right fists to their chests. Arlo followed their lead.
"Repeat after me," said Christian.
Arlo nodded.
"Loyal, brave, kind, and true, keeper of the old and new."
Connor stood in front of Arlo, unfolding a new blue neckerchief, the same color as the rest of his patrols. Arlo felt stupid for not realizing the patrol colors matched the neckerchiefs. He hadn't worn Uncle Wade's, mostly because of the bloodstain, but also because he wasn't sure how to tie it. It was still bunched up in his pocket. Placing the blue neckerchief around Arlo's collar, Connor slid a metal ring up to fasten it.
"I guard the wild, defend the weak, mark the path, and virtue seek. Forest spirits, hear me now, as I speak my ranger's vow."
With the oath finished, everyone relaxed out of their salute. Arlo put his hand down. His palm was sweaty. Christian made it official.
"Arlo Finch has taken his ranger's vow. May his path be safe."
All the other rangers spoke in unison. "May his aim be true." 6. The Field Book. The ranger field book was paperback, an inch thick, and heavy. The pages were crisp and smelled new, but the text and illustrations seemed old, like it hadn't been updated in decades. Arlo received his field book after the meeting. The company quartermaster, a girl in senior patrol, took one from the locked cabinet in the supply room. With a black marker, she wrote "Finch" on the top edge of the book in big letters.
"You're only issued one," she said, "so don't lose it."
Arlo couldn't imagine ever letting it out of his sight. It was too dark to read on the car ride home, but the illustrations were mysterious and fascinating. Traps and creatures and canoeing techniques. The back of the book showed the various patches. He spotted some of the ones from Uncle Wade's shirt, but many more as well, featuring animal tracks, flaming arrows, and watchtowers. He wanted to stay up all night reading the book, yet at the same time he wanted to save it so he could read it page by page. As he flipped past a drawing of tents, he suddenly remembered.
"There's a camp out this weekend. I can go, right?"
"Of course," his mom said. As he pulled into the driveway, Arlo spotted Cooper standing watch in the moonlight. He wondered if there was anything in the field book about ghost dogs.
There just had to be.
That night in bed, Arlo studied the book by flashlight until his batteries ran out. The field book covered constellations, topographic maps, flag folding, fire building, boot maintenance, snake bites, avalanches, water purification, knots, ticks, totem lore, bears, poisonous plants, snare traps, hiking, tracking, knife sharpening, first aid, shock, packing, stick biscuits, smoke signals, trail signs, lashing, wood lore, edible plants, slings, splints, compound fractures, stretchers, conservation, and tornadoes. It had nothing to say about ghost dogs, however. In fact, the only reference for ghost in the index was a page warning about the dangers of camping in graveyards. The listing for spirit featured 34 entries, but most of them were for spirit in the sense of teamwork rather than disembodied supernatural entity. The back third of the field book was devoted to ranks and badges. Arlo couldn't make sense of it by flashlight, but Indra and Wu filled in the details the next day at school. There were 5 ranks in Rangers: Squirrel, Owl, Wolf, Ram, and Bear. Even without looking at the patch on the left shirt pocket, it was pretty easy to guess a Ranger's rank. The youngest ones were Squirrels. Most 8th and 9th graders were Owls. The older ones were Wolves and Rams. And no one was a Bear. because there were no bears. Wu, Indra, and the twins were all squirrels. Their rank patches depicted a bushy-tailed squirrel in profile, an acorn held in its front paws. Being the youngest members, squirrels took a fair amount of teasing, gentle and otherwise. Wu recounted how, during a recent campout, Red Patrol had yelled, "Feed the squirrels!" while raining pine cones down on Blue. Connor was an owl, as were most of the patrol leaders. His rank patch showed a hunting owl in flight, its wide wings curving up while its talons bore down. Earning owl required 7 specific skill patches, many of which Indra had already earned. Wu had been gooed by a fairy beetle while trying to finish his watching. Senior patrol was almost entirely wolves. Their rank patches featured a howling wolf, its head tipped up to the sky. It took most rangers 4 years to earn wolf, although Indra calculated it was possible to do it in as little as 2.5 with proper planning and a valid passport.
"You would need to go to Australia or New Zealand over Christmas break, which is our winter but their summer, and join a company that is headed to camp and get elected patrol leader. While you're there, you get your leadership and tracking patches half a year earlier than you could have here."
Indra had gone as far as researching a ranger company in Auckland that might work, but was waiting until her next birthday to share the idea with her parents. With massive curled horns set against a floating head, the ram patch looked more dragon than sheep. Christian Cunningham and 2 other high school kids were the only rams in the company.
"Most kids never get to that rank," Wu explained. "There's a ton of stonecraft and weathering, which are super hard. It's basically math, but with rocks and clouds."
The bear patch was the most unusual, because it didn't depict a bear at all, but rather a leafless tree. Arlo had seen it only in the field book, because no ranger in Pine Mountain Company had achieved the rank for a 12 years. Christian was said to be going for his, but dodged the question when asked directly. Wu said the training, called the Vigil, required leaving Colorado for weeks at a time, with strict secrecy over exactly what was taught.
"It's super Jedi ninja stuff."
As a new member, Arlo was unranked, with no patch on his pocket. He was the only unranked ranger in the entire company, but that was simply because of timing. At the start of every summer, 5 or 6 new kids joined Rangers, all starting from zero, like Arlo. By September, they invariably earned Squirrel. Joining in the late fall put Arlo behind, but he was determined to catch up. In order to achieve the rank of Squirrel, he would have to meet the rank requirements in the back of the field book. Repeat from memory the Ranger's vow. He was already off to a bad start. The vow was only 35 words long, but they simply wouldn't stick properly in his head. By the time he got to defend the weak, his mind had wandered away. It was that way with most things Arlo had to memorize. After 6 years of daily recital at various elementary schools, he still fumbled his way through the Pledge of Allegiance. At baseball games, the national anthem was completely befuddling, the Rockets' red glare seeming to have wandered in from another song altogether. Demonstrate the Ranger's salute. This was easy. To salute, you placed your right fist over your heart, knuckles touching your chest. Your thumb needed to be flat against your curled fingers, in line with your arm, never giving the thumbs up sign, or worse, tucked inside the fist. Spend 3 nights camping with your patrol. There was a camp out every month, including one this weekend. Show how to tie the 10 Rangers' knots. Explain how each is used. Arlo studied the illustrations in the field book. Even with the arrows, it was tough to get them right, but it felt like the kind of thing that just required practice. Demonstrate your proficiency with the Ranger's compass. Arlo didn't have his Ranger's compass yet, but Wu had described the process for the test.
They give you a shape, like a triangle or a cross, and you have to walk that pattern, ending up at exactly the same spot you started. The hardest part is keeping your paces even.
Wu completed it on his first try, but it had taken Indra 3 attempts. Successfully complete your trial of rank. Once he had finished all the other requirements, Arlo would have to demonstrate what he'd learned in front of a panel of rangers and answer their questions.
"You don't know who is on your panel until you get there," said Wu. "And they can ask you anything, like how deep you're supposed to bury your poop, or the difference between Kinnick-Kinnick and Bearberry. At the end, they vote, and if you don't pass, you have to wait 3 months until your next trial."
"You have to be prepared for anything," said Indra.
With the field book in his hands, Arlo felt like he actually could be ready. From patches to pine cones, sunburns to signal fires, the book made the Ranger universe seem orderly. That Friday afternoon, as he packed his backpack according to the book's lists and illustrations, he didn't worry that he was forgetting anything. As long as he followed the instructions, everything would be fine. When it came to Rangers, the field book had all the answers. Except for the questions Arlo hadn't thought to ask. 7. The Wonder. Arlo could not believe how far they hiked. Every time he thought they had reached the top of the mountain, the trail just kept going, with another peak ahead. The distance was not the problem. Arlo was used to walking. Back in Chicago, they would often walk a mile to the museum, even in the winter when it was so cold it hurt to breathe and his ears started ringing. But Chicago was flat. Everything in Colorado was on a slope, and there were always rocks to step over or step around. Did it take more energy to step over or around a rock? He wanted to ask, but he was too tired to speak. His only consolation was that the hike seemed to be just as exhausting for Wu and Indra. Back when they'd first put on their packs at the car, they were discussing whether hammocks counted as beds or not. Wu was convinced they did. After all, you could sleep in a hammock. Indra said that by Wu's logic, anything a person could conceivably fall asleep in was a bed, be it a couch, a car, or an airplane. Wu and Indra both tried to sway Arlo to their side, but by the end of the first half mile, the argument was abandoned unresolved. The entire company was hiking to Ram's Meadow, one of their frequent campsites. Responsibility for planning the monthly camping trip rotated among patrols. This time, it was Green Patrol's turn. They had chosen Ram's Meadow after a lengthy discussion and 3 rounds of secret ballot. Wu said Blue Patrol always picked 3 creeks, which apparently had the best fishing. Arlo had never been fishing and did not like fish, but was certain his patrol was correct in their choice.
"Hold up," whispered Connor.
He stopped them, then pointed to something deep in the forest.
"Wow,"
whispered Wu, impressed. Indra agreed.
"I can't believe it's so close."
"Cool,"
whispered Arlo, but he didn't notice anything, no matter how hard he looked. All he could see was trees. All he could hear was his pulse in his ears. Yet his entire patrol seemed to be watching something remarkable. Arlo tried to follow their gaze. Connor must have spotted his frustration because he waved him over closer. With just a tiny shift to the left, Arlo saw it. It was a deer. Or an elk. Arlo wasn't sure what to call this creature he had only seen in picture books, standing just off the trail, watching them. It was so close that Arlo could see the glint in its black eyes and the texture of its fur. He could watch it breathing. More than any creature he had ever encountered in the wild, Arlo felt that this one had a name, a family, a story. And then, boom! From behind them, a cannon shot. The deer took off running, terrified. Arlo looked back to see Red Patrol approaching. One of the boys wiggled his hands and clapped them together. The resulting noise was 1,000 times louder than expected, a true explosion. Arlo felt his heart skip.
"Not cool, Russell," said Connor. "It's a deer. Get over it."
The boy's name was Russell Stokes. Arlo recognized him as the one who'd called him Arlo Flinch at the meeting. Red Patrol skirted past them on the narrow trail. There were icy glares and grumbles, but no words were exchanged. Once they were out of earshot, Arlo asked, "What was that? How did he do that?"
It's called a thunderclap, said Wu. You don't learn that until you reach Owl.
But what is it? Arlo asked as they started hiking again. I mean, it's like, well, it's...
He racked his brain for a different term, something that would explain what he meant without seeming crazy. But ultimately, only one word made sense.
It's magic.
It's not magic, said Indra.
Wu agreed.
Magic is spells and stuff. Rangers don't do that.
Off Indra's look, he quickly added,
Well, we're not supposed to do that.
But what Russell did is impossible, said Arlo. It's not natural. People can't do that.
The trio hung back a bit from the rest of the group so they could talk privately.
Do you know how to walk on a tightrope?
Asked Indra.
No, said Arlo.
But you've seen people walk on tightropes, like on TV. You know it's a thing people can do.
Yes.
So how do you think they do it?
They learn. They practice.
Exactly. A thunderclap is a skill, just like walking on a tightrope. Just because most people can't do it doesn't mean it's magic.
But why wouldn't I have seen it before now? Said Arlo.
Because it only works in certain places, said Wu.
Indra held out her left hand.
Imagine this is the normal world. Every place you've ever been, every city, every town.
She then held out her right hand.
Imagine this is the Long Woods. It's not our world, but it's right next door. Normally, you would never see it, never know it's there. Except there are some places where the two worlds brush up against each other.
She slid her hands past each other, barely touching.
When they do that, it creates friction. Energy.
Like static electricity? Asked Arlo.
Indra and Wu exchanged a look, impressed. Arlo was getting it.
These mountains, they have a lot of that energy. And if you know how to use it, how to focus and shape it, you can do things with it.
When do I learn? Asked Arlo.
You already started, said Wu. You're a ranger now.
Ram's Meadow was worth the hike. Two-thirds of the way up a mountain, the clearing had vast fields of wildflowers and massive boulders that looked like the toes of giants. Rabbit-like creatures called pikas kept watch from the lichen-covered rocks. After some squabbling with Red Patrol over campsites, the Blues picked their spot and set up their tents. Dinner was hot dogs and beans cooked over the fire. Both were extra delicious from the smoke and exhaustion. Arlo had never sat around a campfire before. It was strangely hypnotic, like watching a television with only one channel. Logs slowly disintegrated into glowing embers. White flakes of ash fluttered up, carried by invisible currents. A flash of light caught his attention. Far in the distance, a few of the senior patrol rangers were standing in a line. One by one, they were pointing their fingers, sending out streaking white plumes of light that arced across the night sky before slowly dimming and falling.
"Are those fireworks?" asked Arlo.
"They are snap lights," said Indra.
"It's like you're snapping your fingers," explained Connor. "But instead of sound, you make light." He stood and demonstrated. With a flick of his hand, he snapped his fingers. A bright flare of light erupted, shooting away like a tiny comet.
"It's all light, no heat, so you can't catch anything on fire. Rangers use them all the time. They're better than flashlights."
Arlo tried, but nothing happened. It was like he was trying to get someone's attention and failing.
"Imagine the air is a piece of paper," said Connor. "You're trying to form a sharp crease. The light follows that edge." "It's all about the timing," explained Wu.
He demonstrated, but the light barely left his fingertips. It fizzled out before it even really started. Indra's snap light was more like a firefly, a faint glow that quickly dimmed. Twins Julie and Jonas had slightly better snap lights, each lasting about 3 seconds. Their older sister had been in Rangers, so they'd learned from her. None of their snap lights could compare to Connor's. He could send three in quick succession, or bounce them like a stone skipping across a lake. Arlo kept trying, but all he achieved was sore fingers.
"You'll get it eventually," said Connor.
"It takes a couple of months." Watching the lights zip across the meadow, Arlo reminded himself that it wasn't technically magic, but it sure felt like it.
"Why doesn't anyone ever talk about this?" he asked. "Snap lights and thunderclaps? People in Chicago or Philadelphia, they'd be amazed. Why don't I see videos of it on the internet?"
"It's called the wonder," said Connor. "You can't photograph it or record it. You can only see it for yourself."
Wu skewered another marshmallow to roast.
"It's like when there's a full moon and it looks giant, but then when you take a picture of it, it's actually normal size."
"It's nothing like that," said Indra. "You're talking about an illusion. Snap lights and thunderclaps are real. They just can't be photographed."
"Like the giant moon."
"You'd still have a photo of the moon. It just wouldn't look big. If you try to take a picture of a snap light or a fairy beetle, it doesn't show up at all."
"But you could tell someone about them," said Arlo. "You could describe them, what they're like."
"No one would believe you," said Wu, blowing out his flaming marshmallow. "That's the wonder. The same reason this stuff only works here. It only makes sense here."
"And places like here," added Connor. "There are rangers all over the world."
"Because the Longwoods go everywhere?"
guessed Arlo.
"Exactly," said Connor. "But the farther you get from the edge of the Longwoods, the less wonder there is. It's not just snap lights and thunderclaps. It's the actual idea of them. It fades away, like a dream."
Arlo thought about his mother growing up in Pine Mountain. She must have known about these things as a kid. But over time, those memories had disappeared. He felt sorry for his mom. Her childhood must have been full of wonder, but she couldn't remember it.
"Even in town, the wonder isn't nearly as strong," said Jonas. "You can't do a snap light or anything. Our mom doesn't even think about it. She has no idea what we can do up here."
"But adults in town know about the Longwoods, don't they?" asked Arlo. He turned to Wu.
"Like the nurse at school. She was helping you clean off the purple goo, so she must know about fairy beetles."
"Not really," said Wu. "It's weird. Most adults, it's like they know, but they don't know. They'll always find some other explanation."
Connor agreed. "My dad was in Rangers when he was a kid, but when you ask him about it, it's clear he doesn't really remember it right. It's like his memories are in black and white rather than color."
"One theory is that the wonder is like a natural defense," said Indra. "It's how the Longwoods stay secret, by making you forget they even exist."
Connor was called away for a patrol leaders' meeting to discuss plans for tomorrow. Around the campfire, Wu observed how much better Connor was at snap lights and thunderclaps.
"It's not surprising, considering what he's been through," said Indra. "He'd have to be better, just to survive."
"What do you mean?" asked Arlo.
She'd clearly expected him to ask the question.
"So all this happened when we were little, like 3 years old. So it's not like we remember it ourselves."
"But everyone knows," said Wu. "Our parents have told us about it."
"Our sister was there," added Jonas, roasting a marshmallow. "She was in kindergarten with both of them."
"Both of who?" asked Arlo.
"And Connor will talk about it sometimes," said Indra. "But you don't ever want to bring it up."
Everyone looked to see that Connor was still out of earshot.
"So, back when Connor was like 5 or 6, his family went camping at High Cross. It's really pretty, but we never go there anymore."
"Obviously," said Wu.
Indra continued.
"Connor was there, and his brother Christian, and their cousin Katie. They were playing hide-and-seek. Christian was looking for them, but he couldn't find them anywhere. He was yelling for them. No answer. It was starting to get dark, so he told his parents. No one could find Connor and Katie. That night, the whole town began looking for them. There were search parties and tracking dogs. They had helicopters flying in from Denver."
"They even had psychics and shamans and stuff," said Wu.
"How did they find them?" asked Arlo.
"They never did."
Indra paused for dramatic effect.
"The search went on for 3 weeks, and eventually they called it off, because there was no way anyone could still be alive out there."
Arlo was confused.
"But Connor is alive."
"A month after they disappeared, Connor suddenly showed up in Canada, thousands of miles away. No one could explain how he'd gotten there. Connor couldn't remember anything after he'd been playing hide-and-seek. He had no idea where Katie was.
They never found her? Asked Arlo.
No, said Wu. No trace at all.
Our mom says the trolls got her, said Julie.
It was the first time she had spoken in an hour.
There are trolls? Asked Arlo.
In the Longwoods? Of course. The field book doesn't even list half the things you'd find there, said Indra. Officially, the police say that someone must have kidnapped the two of them and Connor got away, but everyone here knows that they probably crossed into the Longwoods somehow. That's why no one could find them, because they weren't even in our world anymore. Somehow Connor found his way out, but in Canada rather than Colorado.
Because the Longwoods go everywhere, said Arlo.
Exactly, said Wu. And distances there aren't the same. You could walk 10 miles through the Longwoods and end up in Brazil.
The hardest part is not dying, said Indra. Most grown-ups, even wardens, they couldn't last one night in the Longwoods. For a 5-year-old to survive out there for a week, much less a month, is unheard of.
His meeting over, Connor was headed back to the campfire. They needed to wrap this up. But first, Arlo had to ask an important question.
Connor's cousin, if she was still in the Longwoods, she'd be about our age now, right?
I guess, but there's no way she could still be alive, said Wu.
As he drank his clumpy hot chocolate, Arlo pictured the girl he'd seen in the reflection, and the way she'd reacted when he had said, Pine Mountain. The thoughts came to him in a rush. Maybe she knew the name Pine Mountain because it was where she used to live. Because she was Connor's missing cousin. And if so, Arlo was the only one who knew she was alive.
8. Lights in the Dark. Arlo woke up confused about where he was. In the dim light, he saw finger-like shadows above him, swaying back and forth. To his right, an unseen animal was growling. Worse, his arms were immobilized, pinned at his side. He started to panic. Then he remembered he was camping. The tent, which had seemed so spacious when they first set it up, was a lot smaller with their sleeping bags out. Jackets were piled on top of boots by the zippered door. The growling animal was Wu. He snored in a way that seemed impossible, making noise on both the inhale and the exhale. It wasn't particularly loud, except that everything else was so quiet. Arlo could hear the wind in the grass and the burbling of a distant stream. It was like turning up the static on a radio, hearing the background noise as music. Arlo's arms really were pinned, but it was because the sleeping bag was so narrow. Connor called them mummy bags, but they were more like cocoons or puffy down parkas for your body. They tapered until there was just enough room for your feet. Connor's bag was brand new, top of the line, designed for climbers scaling Mount Everest. It came from a catalog that sold collapsible kayaks and tiny stoves. Arlo's sleeping bag came from the back of the quartermaster's supply closet. It had probably been used by 50 different rangers over the years. It smelled like nylon and spit and smoke and sunscreen, but he had to admit it kept him plenty warm. The night air was cold on his cheeks, but his body was toasty. He turned over and tried to fall back asleep. His pillow was actually his hooded sweatshirt, folded up on itself and wrapped in its hood, just the way Wu had shown him. It was comfortable enough, but there was a rock somewhere under his hip. It took a lot of wiggling to find a position where the rock didn't poke him. And then he realized he needed to pee. Or did he? Could he wait? After all, it was going to be morning soon, he assumed, not really having any idea of the time and not having a watch, but certain that it had to be nearer to morning than night, considering he'd fallen asleep and woken up. Arlo decided he could wait. It would be easier if he waited. Then he heard a beep. It was a single, low, digital chime. It came from behind him. Arlo rolled over to face Wu. The slumbering growler had his arm out over his sleeping bag, and on his wrist,
a digital watch. Arlo snaked his hand out of his bag and carefully tapped Wu's watch until he found the backlight. It was midnight. Midnight. He'd only been asleep 2 hours. It was another 6 hours until dawn. There was no way he was going to make it until morning to pee. Arlo unzipped his bag as quietly as he could, careful not to wake Connor or Wu. He found his boots easily enough. He didn't bother lacing them tight. Connor's coat was on the top of the pile. The jacket had no doubt come from the same catalog as Connor's sleeping bag, designed for alpine adventures by bearded men wearing mirrored sunglasses that wrapped tight to the face like goggles. The parka had 17 pockets and special loops for hanging accessories. It had so many different trademarked fabrics, it was probably bulletproof. Arlo's coat was at the bottom of the pile. It only had 2 pockets, with snaps rather than zippers, and a drawstring hood with the cord half pulled out. The cuff of the right sleeve was still wet from where he had spilled hot chocolate earlier. And then a thought occurred to Arlo. Just wear Connor's coat. Connor wouldn't know or care. In fact, if Connor were awake, he would probably say, "Why are you even asking? Of course you can wear it." Connor would say this because rangers are kind. It's in the vow. It would be kind for Connor to let Arlo wear his amazing coat rather than the crappy coat with the snap pockets and hot chocolate on the cuff. And once this offer was made, it would likewise be kind for Arlo to say yes. Kind meant nearly the same thing as polite, and the opposite of polite was rude. And there was never a good reason to be rude. So, in the spirit of kindness, Arlo put on Connor's parka. It was amazing, like sliding your arms into a daydream. He never wanted to take this coat off. He unzipped the tent just enough to slip outside. The night air was bracingly cold and immediately snapped Arlo out of his half slumber. Still, Connor's incredible coat kept his torso warm. Even the pockets were lined with microfiber fleece. Without the campfire's orange glow, the tents looked dark and deserted, clustered together like sleeping rhinos. Arlo realized he was probably the only ranger awake. Even the adults were sleeping. He was maybe the only person awake in the whole valley. Arlo looked up, amazed to see so many tiny lights. It was a moonless night. All the spaces between the bright stars revealed smaller, dimmer stars. Just above the trees, he could make out a broad smear of light, the Milky Way, or at least an arm of it. He had seen it in the planetarium in Chicago, but never in real life. Standing alone in the forest under 10,000 sparkling stars, Arlo Finch felt small, but not in a bad way. Rather, it felt like being let in on a secret about the vastness of the universe. A goldfish set loose in the ocean. As his breath fogged the night air, Arlo spent a few moments in quiet contemplation. He wondered if his father saw the same stars in China. He wondered how many of these stars had names, and who named them, and if they ever just gave out goofy names, like Snarklebutt, because why not? Arlo wondered if some kid on a planet circling one of these stars was looking in Earth's direction, wondering the same things. Given how many billions of stars there were in the universe, it seemed likely, maybe inevitable, that there were other worlds almost like this one. Arlo's mind was racing. And his bladder was full. He really had to pee. He headed off for the trees. He wasn't sure how far from the tents was the appropriate distance to urinate. Tomorrow he'd look it up in the field book. Tonight, he'd just trust his instincts. At the edge of the clearing, he found a tree suited to the purpose. As he was finishing up, he spotted something. A light. It was deeper in the forest, the size of a flashlight, but definitely not a flashlight. Arlo watched as the light bobbed and weaved among the trees. It was floating. Or flying. Or dancing. There was no music, but Arlo sensed that it was moving to a rhythm, its light growing slightly brighter or dimmer to a steady beat. Suddenly, there was another light. It was the same size, but slightly pinker. The two lights swirled, chasing each other like birds at the park. The faster they moved, the more they seemed to blur, leaving smoky, sparkling trails in the air. Arlo moved closer, careful not to spook them. As best he could tell, they were just glowing spheres of light. Each was the size of a baseball, with no visible wings, which meant it was impossible for them to fly. But ghost dogs and fairy beetles were similarly impossible, and they both seemed to be real, so Arlo's skepticism was dialed pretty low these days. Arlo wondered if these were snaplights that had somehow come alive. He had seen the older rangers casting snaplights that hung in the air for 20 seconds before slowly falling. What if some snaplights never fell, but instead lived on? Then he thought, what if this is the wonder? All the impossible things which suddenly aren't. A twig snapped under Arlo's foot. The dancing lights seemed to hear it, stopping their chase to hover for a moment. Arlo froze. The lights eventually began swirling again, heading deeper into the forest. Arlo was determined to be stealthier this time, carefully moving from tree to tree so they wouldn't notice him. The ground under his feet was becoming muddier. He regretted not tying his boots. The laces were dragging in the muck. But he couldn't stop to fix them, because the lights were moving faster. It was tough to keep them in sight while trying to stay somewhat hidden. One of the lights flew straight up, circling a tall tree. Arlo watched as it hid among the branches, growing dim as the other light searched for it. It was sneaky, carefully keeping on the far side of the trunk. Arlo crept closer, never taking his eyes off them. Suddenly, the second light zoomed past Arlo, so close he could feel a whoosh. These things had some substance after all. The glowing sphere hung in front of Arlo, suspended in midair. And then it winked, or blinked. It got dimmer for just a second, but Arlo could swear it was deliberate. "I see you," it was saying, and it wasn't afraid. Arlo felt he should say something. "Hello?" The light blinked again. "What are you? Did someone make—" Before he could finish his question, the light suddenly flew off, joining its friend deeper in the forest. Arlo followed them. This time he didn't worry about being stealthy. He ran to catch up with them. The lights slowed, then stopped, apparently waiting for him to catch up. They gradually rose higher and higher. Arlo hurried to keep them in sight when suddenly, boom! A massive thunderclap rang through the forest. Arlo nearly jumped out of his skin. A boy's voice yelled, "Stop!" Arlo searched amid the dark trees. A snaplight suddenly flared, revealing Connor 100 feet behind him. Connor wasn't wearing a coat, and Arlo suddenly realized why. "I'm sorry," yelled Arlo. "I didn't think you'd—" "Don't move!" Connor sent up 2 more snaplights and slowly approached. Arlo looked up to the glowing lights he had been following. They were circling each other, watching. With the illumination from Connor's snaplights, he could see there was more to them. Swirling shadows surrounded them, like bones made of smoke.
"What are they?"
"Wisps," said Connor.
"They're trying to kill you."
Connor aimed another snaplight just past Arlo's feet, revealing the edge of a pit. 6 feet below, sharp wooden spikes pointed up like spears. It was a simple but deadly trap, and Arlo had run right up to the edge of it. One more step, and Arlo Finch would have been skewered. He carefully backed away. Connor moved beside him. "Cover your ears." Arlo plugged his ears tight. Connor rubbed his hands together in a special way and then clapped them, sending another crashing boom of thunder at the wisps. The living lights swirled. Arlo sensed they were angry, or confused. Their plan of leading him to the trap had nearly worked. The lights bobbed, circled, then flew off deep into the forest, out of sight. Turning around, Arlo could see flashlights and snaplights as other rangers and wardens came to investigate the thunderclaps. Connor sent up a snaplight to show where they were. "Are you boys all right?" yelled one of the wardens. Connor yelled back, "We're fine." He then whispered to Arlo, "Don't say anything about the wisps. They'll make us go home tonight." The wardens believed Connor's story about Arlo getting lost in the woods, but Indra didn't. As soon as the adults left, she snuck into their tent and demanded the real story. With Connor's blessing, Arlo told her and Wu exactly what had happened.
"Why would wisps be this far out of the Longwoods?"
asked Indra.
"I don't know," said Connor.
"Maybe they were hungry," suggested Wu. "It says in the field book that they lure creatures to their death to eat their souls."
"Then who made the trap?" asked Arlo. "They don't have hands. Someone had to build that."
"And it wasn't an old trap either," said Connor. "We camp up here all the time. We would have seen it before."
Indra was certain she had the answer.
"Someone built the trap and sent the wisps to lure you into it. It wasn't an accident or a coincidence. It was planned."
Arlo was reeling. "You're saying that someone is trying to kill me?"
"Of course not," she said. "They were trying to kill Connor. You were just wearing his coat."
9. The Gold Pan. The Gold Pan was Pine Mountain's only restaurant, unless you counted the hot dogs at the gas station. The little diner had been operating in the same spot as long as anyone could remember. Framed photos on the walls showed the building with every era of car parked in front of it, even some horses. In one picture, two men with shovels were carving a path through a massive snowdrift to the door. Only the Gold Pan sign on the roof was visible.
"That was your grandfather," said Arlo's mom, pointing to one of the men.
Arlo squinted, but he couldn't see any details in the man's face. The black and white photo was grainy, and the glass in the frame had a layer of dust and grease.
"Did Granddad work here?" asked JC as she set up the laptop in a corner booth.
"No, but the snow that year was so bad everyone had to help out. The town was cut off for weeks until they finally got the pass back open."
JC's laptop made a familiar series of bloops.
"We're connecting," she said.
Arlo slid in next to her in the booth, watching as gibberish scrolled up the laptop's screen. Because of what happened with the FBI, they had to use special software to talk with their father in China.
"You smell like a sweaty campfire," said JC.
Arlo sniffed his sleeve, but he couldn't smell it. She was probably right. Arlo had come straight from the campout. Suddenly, his father was on the screen.
"Hey, kiddos, how's life on the mountain?"
The video stuttered a bit, but eventually sharpened. Arlo's dad was skinny and bearded, with glasses that seemed an essential part of his face. Arlo was relieved that, as crazy as things seemed, his dad remained exactly the same. Over pancakes and French fries, it was more lunchtime than breakfast, Arlo and JC filled their father in on what had happened since they'd arrived in Pine Mountain. Arlo omitted a few things, like nearly being killed in a pit of sharp spikes by glowing wisps that came from the Longwoods. And he left out other details, such as thunderclaps and snaplights and Cooper the ghost dog who kept silent watch over the house. He mostly told his father about school. It's fine. And Rangers. It's fun. JC did the bulk of the talking anyway, describing in detail her classes and her locker and why she was thinking about switching from clarinet to drums and marching band. She said that one of the snares had come down with mononucleosis, which sounded like something from a superhero movie, but was actually really common, and that left an opening for a new drummer. Arlo marveled at how different JC was when she was talking with their father. In normal life, she was grouchy and sullen, but with Dad, she lit up, smiling and laughing. Their mom didn't chime in much. Arlo knew his parents emailed and sometimes spoke on the phone, particularly about money and this lawyer in California who was trying to make it safe for his dad to come back to the States. The video calls were just for Arlo and JC, so it wouldn't feel like their dad was so far away. After about 15 minutes, a familiar alert popped up in the corner of the screen. It warned they were losing the proxy, which meant they had less than 10 seconds before the call would drop. Squeezing to fit in front of the camera, they each gave a quick, "love you," and "bye." Then the connection terminated. They were left hugging themselves, watching a frozen, pixelated image of their dad. JC took a screenshot and added it to a folder. While Arlo finished his pancakes, his mom went to the counter to pay the bill. JC kept her voice low, which was never a good sign.
"I'm getting a job."
"Where?" asked Arlo.
"Here at the diner. There's a sign in the window. They're hiring a part-time waitress."
"You've never been a waitress." Arlo couldn't imagine his sister carrying a tray of food. She was strong enough, certainly. She was stronger than most girls her age, but she was clumsy. Back when they used to play tag in the park, she was constantly tripping. She blamed her shoes, but Arlo was pretty sure her feet weren't connected to her brain quite right.
"I can do it," JC said. "And we need the money, so if it comes up, tell Mom you don't need me to babysit you."
"I don't," he exclaimed.
"Exactly."
Their mom came back from the counter with a smile Arlo hadn't seen in a while.
"Good news," she said. "Your mom just got hired as a waitress. I start tomorrow."
Arlo was careful not to glance at his sister. He didn't need to. He knew the look in her eyes. Back at the house, Arlo started a load of laundry, careful to make sure the water didn't overflow as the washing machine tub filled up.
"One time in 20, it'll just keep running," Uncle Wade had warned him, "and then the carpet will be squishing for weeks."
Water rose to an inch below the rim, but the machine finally clicked as the valve switched off. Arlo watched as the agitator began churning back and forth. The last peaks of cloth sank beneath the waves. Arlo's brain felt a lot like his uniform, swirling back and forth, never able to rest. Too many questions were competing for his attention. Who built the trap in the woods? Was it actually meant for Connor? Did someone send the wisps? If so, who and why? What did it have to do with the girl he had seen in the reflection? Could she actually be Connor's lost cousin? And why was she warning Arlo that he was in danger? Every time he tried focusing on one question, another one took its place. They were all hopelessly entangled. Arlo imagined his father facing the same situation. "Every big problem is just a bunch of little problems," his dad would say. "Doesn't matter if it's making dinner or flying to the moon. You've just got to break it into steps." When his father was working, there were whiteboards and index cards and little black notebooks with lists. Arlo didn't really understand what his dad was doing, something about how to tell when someone is eavesdropping on a private conversation, but he understood the process. His father started with complicated things and found ways to make them smaller and easier. Maybe Arlo could do that. He didn't have a whiteboard, so he wrote with his finger on the dust of the window. "Wisps? Cousin?" Then he added a final item. "Why me?" 10. The Bestiary. Arlo decided to start with the wisps. The field book wasn't much help, offering only 2 short sentences. Seen at a distance, wisps are often mistaken for lanterns or torches. They may seek to lure unwary travelers into deadly traps. Based on his encounter, Arlo found this description accurate but unhelpful. It was like saying rocks were heavy and hard and dangerous when thrown at your head. Arlo wanted to know whether the wisps knew what they were doing when they coaxed him into the woods. Was it planning or instinct? Maybe they were like spiders who race out to grab whatever lands in their web. Or maybe they were smarter, more like lions who stalk their prey and wait for the right moment to attack. If they were just dumb flying spiders, Arlo could feel confident they weren't trying to kill him specifically. He had just been in the wrong place at the wrong time. But if they were like lions, or smarter than lions, they might still be stalking him. This time, he would know enough not to follow them into a trap, but it was unnerving to think that something might be out in the woods, watching him. Waiting. Giving up on the field book, Arlo turned to his uncle's encyclopedias, finding the W volume holding up a corner of the couch in the living room. The gold-edged pages were thin and stuck together in places. Arlo finally made it to the proper page. But there was no entry for Wisp. It went straight from Wisdom to Wit.
"We need to look in the bestiary,"
whispered Indra in class the next morning.
"If there's anything about wisps, it'll be there."
At the front of the room, Mrs. Mays pointedly cleared her throat. They were supposed to be finishing their math worksheets.
"Sorry, Mrs. Mays,"
said Indra with a sweet smile. Arlo tried to focus on his fractions, but his curiosity wouldn't let him. He watched as their teacher poured the remains of her coffee over the struggling African violet on her desk. While she was rinsing out the mug in the classroom sink, Arlo whispered to Indra,
"What's a bestiary?"
"It's a book,"
answered Indra and Wu together. Wu was sitting in front of Arlo. All three watched as Mrs. Mays stared at her mug, silently deliberating whether she wanted more coffee. She checked the clock, surveyed the silent classroom, and reached a decision. She walked out the door. Wu immediately turned around in his desk.
"We can go after lunch, while the second graders have library time."
Indra agreed.
"That's perfect."
"Fitz Randolph will be distracted, so we can sneak in behind the counter. She keeps it in a locked drawer, but I've been working on picking locks, so I think I can do it. The question is whether we take it, or just photograph the pages we need and put it back before she knows it's gone. Either way, one of you is going to need to be lookout."
Arlo quickly volunteered.
"Or we could just ask to see the book," said Indra.
Wu considered her suggestion, his fingers tracing the air as if planning a series of steps and outcomes. Finally,
"I guess that would work too."
Mrs. Mays returned to find Wu facing backwards in his seat, talking with Arlo and Indra. It was pretty obvious they weren't working on fractions. At lunch, they finished quickly and half ran to the library, hoping to get there before the second graders swarmed in. Mrs. Fitz Randolph, the school librarian, was a kind-hearted woman with a collection of hand-knitted sweaters and tartan plaid skirts. A burbling humidifier sat on the counter next to a figurine of a Scotty dog playing bagpipes.
"Finch, well, you must be Celeste Bellman's son," she said.
Arlo nodded.
"I babysat your mother when she was little. Not that she needed much supervision. Your uncle, on the other hand..."
She trailed off, a shrug that went all the way to her fingers. Arlo hadn't mentioned his uncle to Indra or Wu, deliberately vague about exactly which house he lived in on Green Pass Road.
"We wanted to show Arlo the bestiary," said Indra. "He's never seen one."
"I'm afraid I have the second graders coming in."
"We'll be quick,"
Indra promised.
"He's never seen a fairy beetle, and we want to let him know what to watch out for."
"Well, that is a good idea," said Mrs. Fitz Randolph, looking to Arlo. "I remember your uncle had a few run-ins with fairy beetles, and stink razors, too."
Flipping through her ring of keys, Mrs. Fitz Randolph reached below the counter to unlock an unseen drawer. Then she placed a well-worn book up on the counter. Cullman's Bestiary of Notable Creatures looked like an old textbook, not much different from the math book they used every day.
"I have to keep it back here because, if it was on the shelf, children wouldn't read anything else," said Mrs. Fitz Randolph. "Hundreds of years of literature all around us, books on every subject and corner of the world, but all anyone wants to look at is this gruesome little catalog."
Just then, a line of second graders arrived. Arlo always forgot how small and squirmy they were.
"You can have 2 minutes," Mrs. Fitz Randolph said, moving around the counter to herd the second graders to the reading tables.
Indra quickly flipped through the book, past fascinating drawings of all manner of strange creatures. Arriving at the W's, her pace slowed until she finally came upon Wisp. Arlo's heart skipped as he saw the illustration. It was a simple sketch, but it included all the right details. The shadowy skeleton, the inner glow, the faint trail of glowing ash that fell off it. Whoever drew this picture had seen a wisp just as clearly as Arlo had. He felt his hands sweating from the memory. Wu read the text out loud, careful to keep his voice low.
"Malevolent spirits of uncertain origin, wisps, also known as fool's fire, feed upon the essence of dying creatures, often after luring victims into natural hazards such as quicksand."
"Or traps," said Indra, "like the one you almost fell into."
Wu kept reading.
"Perimeter wards are generally effective but unnecessary, as wisps are unlikely to engage directly, sometimes summoned and controlled by eldritch spellcasters."
Arlo felt himself nodding, but then realized, "I don't know what most of that means." Indra took it on herself to explain, pointing to the relevant words.
"Spirits means that wisps are like ghosts or phantoms."
"They're not alive," said Wu.
"Well, they sort of are, but they're not alive like people or animals."
She stopped herself to clarify.
"You do know there are ghosts, right?"
"I do," said Arlo, happy to be caught up on at least one thing. Arlo reasoned that wisps must be something like Cooper the dog, who existed partially in this world and partially in another.
"It says that wisps feed on the energy of dying creatures, so they're like vampires?"
"There are no vampires," said Wu.
"Really?"
"No, that's just in stories."
It seemed strange that Pine Mountain had ghosts without vampires, but Arlo was relieved, nevertheless. Indra returned to the book.
"Wards are protections," she explained. "A perimeter ward is a circle that spirits can't cross. You don't learn those until Owl, when you get your elementary wards patch. There's also advanced wards and abjurations, but that's an elective."
"We should have had a ward around the camp, right?" asked Arlo.
"We did," said Wu. "Don't you remember when we were setting up the tents? Connor went around and stacked up rocks? He was building the ward."
Arlo did remember, but he hadn't asked about it at the time.
"So why didn't it work?"
"Because you stepped outside it," said Wu.
Arlo felt foolish, realizing that none of this would have happened if he'd stayed by the tents, or asked why Connor was stacking rocks, or asked more questions in general. He'd been so afraid of seeming stupid that he'd nearly gotten himself killed. Indra went back to the final sentence in the entry.
"Sometimes summoned and controlled by eldritch spellcasters. That's what I was saying in the tent. I think someone built that trap with the spikes and sent the wisps to lure you into it."
"You mean lure Connor into it?" said Wu.
"I guess, unless they really were meant for Arlo. Think about it. Connor has been camping dozens of times in the woods, and nothing ever went after him. This was Arlo's first time."
Indra turned to him.
"Can you think of anyone who would want to kill you?"
"No," he said. "I mean, I just got here."
Wu agreed.
"It has to be Connor. There's a reason they were targeting him. It's something about his cousin."
Arlo only nodded. He wasn't ready to tell them about the girl in the reflection yet. He wouldn't even know where to begin. He pointed to the last few words he didn't understand in the book.
"What does eldritch spellcaster mean?"
"Eldritch means otherworldly," said Indra. "Things in the Longwoods are eldritch."
"And a spellcaster is anything that casts spells," said Wu. "Like a witch."
"There are witches?" asked Arlo.
Indra kept her voice low so the second graders wouldn't hear.
"There are things much worse than witches."
They returned from lunch to find Mrs. Mays holding a seating chart. One by one, she assigned students to new desks. Arlo felt a sinking dread. He had a sense how this would turn out. Indra was placed in the first row, close to the teacher's desk. Wu was two rows back, on the left edge of the room next to the windows. Arlo was assigned a desk on the right side of the room by the cabinets. Merrily Myers was seated next to him. She scrubbed the stray marks off her new desk with her pink eraser, occasionally holding it up to her nose.
"I love how they smell."
She offered it to Arlo. He passed.
"Everything has a smell, you know. even the inside of your nose, she said. But you can't smell it anymore because you're used to it.
Indra turned back in her seat, looking plaintively at Arlo and Wu.